What's going on, everybody? Your boy, Big Dave Martell, here on another episode of The Bog, here on the Robin Volk Network. Make sure you like, subscribe, share, so you can get in the quickly alert bell, so you can get an alert every time we go live here on The Bog, every single Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern, or Tuesday on God's Folk and Destiny with the mighty Stephen McNallan. That's every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern. And also stay tuned for our new show, Kaiser Cooks, with the awesome, my friend, Kaiser Wayne, and also Folkstead with Rory, and then Hen House with Mother Hen. So we have so many great programs coming, so like, subscribe, share, get it all out there. But before we get started, like always, I give a shout out to my homegirl, Miss Hannah, at Traditional Apothecary, traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Stop giving money to these multinational, international corporations that hate your guts, sell you poison and synthetics and plastics that trash your hair, trash your body. You know, our ancestors gifted us with so many wonderful gifts, but one of them is our appearance, man, our features. We are beautiful people, so we need to shine. We need to shine. We got to be maximum handsome, maximum beautiful, take care of our beautiful skin, our hair, all of it. And this is all organic, natural ingredients from United States, from Europe. Really, really, really great stuff. I use it. My wife uses it. My mom uses it. And Dr. G from Neurona Society uses it. He's a doctor. He knows what he's talking about. Him and his wife both use it. So it's doctor approved. TraditionalApothecary.BigCartel.com. Type in promo code Dave to get 10% off. I guarantee you you're going to love this stuff. I love it. And also, make sure to go check out this horn. This is my drinking horn here. It's got my Penfolk symbol right there. Got the Alemannic sun wheel within the keystone, representing my kindred. It's got the beeswax lining, completely custom by my buddy Rob Stam, the Folkish cop. Really, really awesome guy. Member of the AFA, you know, American hero. He was a police officer. Really, really great stuff that this guy makes. Really great stuff. So go find him on Facebook. I'm not sure if he has a website quite yet, but check him out. Rob Stam, S-T-A-M-M. Good friend of mine. So let's get started tonight. I have a really, really awesome guest. Before we introduce him, I'm going to bring on my co-host, Angriff. How you doing tonight, sir? I know you missed out last week because you were having some technical difficulties, but you return. How we doing?
Great to be here again, Dave LeMain.
Hell yeah. You sound good. Got a mic upgrade.
Well, you know, at least my time off was well spent.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So without further ado, I have a really good friend of mine for a long time now out here on the interwebs. He's a warrior himself, American hero, husband, father of five, excellent, excellent friend, great guy, does so many tremendous programs, has done so many tremendous programs. He is the host of Verbo Tempestas, as well as host of the now defunct, but widely popular Conduit, and also the best show, one of my favorite shows on this network, The Folkstead. And he's here tonight to talk to us about survival, about folksteading, all kinds of awesome stuff. Mr. Rory Reddington, how you doing tonight, Mr. Rory?
Man, I'm doing great, brother. Glad to be here with you.
Yes, sir. So let's get started here. Mr. Rory, you do a show on this network, The Folkstead, which I'm sure all the audience is familiar with. But
let's hope so.
Yeah, I mean, I watch. I love it. It's great. You and Sig get into the permaculture. You get into the episode of Animal Husbandry. It's really, really great stuff and very, very purely educational. Your intro's not too shabby either. It's a nice looking show. So
I have to second. I'm also a big fan of the show. So
I appreciate it, guys.
Yeah, it's a great show. So to those people that are listening,
and I also like Verbo Tempestas, even if your drinking game during the Democratic debate almost killed me.
You and me both, man. You and me both.
Yeah, everybody loves Verbo. So Mr. Rory, to the people in the audience that maybe haven't tuned into The Folkstead, can you give us a quick rundown of what the show's about?
Sure. It's really about reconnecting. You know, as we started this network, it was all about reconnecting with our European roots and our heritage and all of the in all of its aspects. And so I knew that we had guys that were here that were covering the, you know, the religious aspects and the spiritual aspects of it. And we had you know, people working in different ways. And I was like, well, you know, what kind of area can I cover? Things that I'm interested in, things that we're currently working towards myself as a family, is becoming more self-sufficient, and like a homesteading mindset, with, you know, the food, the caloric independence, with building our stuff ourselves, with just breaking away from the machine as much as possible, so that you have that resilience already built in, because it gives you that better mindset. And I think that it's fundamental, rebuilding that mindset and that culture within our people to give us that sense of independence in ourselves and trust in ourselves, that we don't need these outside influencers to make our lives better.
And how long has Folkstead been going on now?
Oh, man. Well, since the beginning of the network. So what was it? March, April? We do weekly shows. They're only 1 hour, real quick, so people can digest them real quickly. You know, wanted to keep it kind of clean and concise. They're really kind of primers in different areas. Obviously, we're not doing these 10-hour deep dive documentary style things. We'll take one aspect, one facet of independence and things you can do on your homestead, and kind of condense, like, okay, here's some important points. Here's some things to think about, to kind of wet people's whistle, if you will, to get them to, you know, look further and research into that. And we stay in communication in the comments and with people online that have questions to kind of fill that gap. But it's really just to get people thinking about things that they may not normally think about in their kind of urban lives, that you can do these things. You don't need 100 acres. There's a lot of these things. And I always point to the things that, even if you live in an apartment, there's a lot of things you can do on your patio in your apartment, you know, as just a starter to get you in that mindset.
Yeah. And this is what we're going to do tonight. We're going to do like a little bit of an exercise, because Mr. Rory, I know that, you know, you fought overseas. You were a military guy. You have, you know, tons of training. You grew up in the Lone Star State. You grew up a country life. So you are pretty familiar with, you know, things like survival, things, you know, that are part of, you know, you've had training for extreme situations and grew up, you know, being pretty self-sufficient. So this is kind of what we're going to do tonight. We're going to play a little bit of a game with Mr. Rory. We're going to kind of paint a, you know, a situation where everything goes down. You know, say there's some sort of collapse. Ragnarok happens, whether it could be like an EMP or financial collapse or any, all of the above. There's a collapse. We no longer have the infrastructure that we do. We have to start from scratch. You have nothing. So it's you and your family, and you got to figure out how to survive. And we're going to go from the collapse all the way to having a sustainable Folkstead, having your, you know, living off the land and doing stuff like that. So, Mr. Griff, I'm going to put you on the spot. Paint us a picture. The collapse happened. Where is Mr. Rory? Paint the intro for us.
Well, I think the biggest thing that, to people who don't think in this way of collapse, that they don't understand, is that the greater complexity of the modern society is not a strength in terms of robustness, but in fact a weakness. Things that really fuck us over are reliance on things like the just-in-time logistics system. That means, you know, your local grocery store has at probably at best 3 days supply of most of the essential foods. And, you know, even the local warehouse distribution will only have a few days, because that's what the whole just-in-time system is about, increasing efficiency by reducing the amount of stuff you keep on hand, because you're reducing spoilage and also reducing the amount of shelf space you need, etc. So really, when you're looking at something like that, people tend to think of, okay, the electricity will be out for a while, or maybe indefinitely, or the water, so I need a local water source. But as Rory alluded to already, in that kind of situation, you need to be prepared for full caloric independence. And I think that people even, it's something of a, you know, something of a trope that people will think of, oh, okay, overnight collapse. We're not talking overnight, but as I said, these complex just-in-time logistics systems mean that things will fall apart faster than most people would actually really believe. So such a situation, as you said, whether it's, you know, peak oil, whether it's an EMP, whether it's a financial thing, it's going to mean you might not be able to get food for months at a time, maybe even years. That about cover it?
So, Mr. Rory, you have nothing. As Mr. Griff just painted for us, There's no immediate supply of food. You have what's in your house, which is probably what the average household has. You have a few days, maybe a week. You know, what do you do? What does it look like right now?
Well, your most essential thing is going to be to get away from this, from the danger, which the highest danger is going to be other people. If you're in some type of urban scenario, if you're in the rural scenario, then you probably already know most of the people around you. You guys can network together. You guys can, make things happen, pull your supplies, start working on, hey, who's growing what? Are we making, let's figure out what we're doing here. But in an urban scenario, you don't have that availability. There's way too many people. There's without these networks of food supply chains, there's not enough food. You're never going to grow enough food, and people are going to, go wild as they tend to do. And so you want to separate yourself from that as quickly as possible. And put some distance. That's going to be your fundamental thing. Which it doesn't take that long, even on foot, to put distance between yourself and the urban sprawl.
And where do you go? How do you go about doing it? You get in your car, or do you go on foot?
It's according to what kind of scenario it is. There are situations, according to how dense you are into the city. If you're in suburbia and you're on the outskirts, you might be able to get away with taking a vehicle. But for the most part, and in most of the situations you can think about, if you live in the urbanized situation, the roads are going to be gridlock and things like that. So the best thing to do is to go on foot and pick a direction, that's the closest direction out of town, out of the main part of town. Obviously, you want to be, if you don't already have food supplies available, you don't want to just completely walk out just randomly into the woods without the skill sets to feed yourself. Some of us are a little bit better at that than others. Some of us can go in the woods and trap and fish and hunt and we'd be just fine. But for most people, that's not an option. So you're going to want to stay close enough to where other people are without being in a densely populated area. So, get outside of the main city, but go towards, smaller little areas that people tend to be a little bit kinder, and you might be able to coordinate with other people to help yourself survive. I would say that if at this point you've reached this point of collapse and you don't already have those skill sets in place, you may just be FUPAR,
How do you feel about this idea of a quote unquote bug out bag for people that are in situations like you described, like the urban or suburban, that aren't in a rural place where they have friends and neighbors?
Well, bug out bags are essential for a lot of different scenarios. I know, like when we went through the Hurricane Harvey in Houston, and I had to get my wife and kids out of the house quickly. I told the kids, grab your bug out bags, and in just a couple minutes they're at the door ready to go with their essentials, and we got the hell out of Dodge. We were trudging through water. That's a whole nother long story, but yeah, I was able to get them out because they were prepared and ready to go. I think that bug out bags are essential because you never know when it's all situational. There are plenty of situations where if you're in the right place, bugging in may be appropriate, get your supplies, stay, because there's a lot of times they're short situationals where, hey, the power grid's going to be down for a couple weeks. There's no supplies at the grocery store. You may have looting and things like that. The safest place you can be is armed and in your house, guarding your supplies and staying safe. If it's more of an extended situation, you're going to want to get away from these people, because people are the biggest danger in these situations.
Okay, so let's say that you've escaped the urban scenario, or you are in the suburban region, and you've kind of left all of the immediate danger behind, all of the people, all the stuff like that, and you've made it to a more rural area. How do you get started? Like, obviously, you don't have enough food to wait until the tomatoes grow. You could probably go hunt something, but you need more nutrition than just meat, right?
Yeah, well, there's plenty of scavenging that could be done. That's why one of the most important things to have in your bug out bag and in your scenario is seeds. Seeds are essential. Because you could take some of those seeds and just literally sprout microgreens real fast to get yourself some nutrition if you had to.
And what about vitamins?
Microgreens are chock full of vitamins and minerals and all that stuff you need.
I was talking about like a multivitamin. Would you want to carry that?
No, those things are pretty useless anyway, even in real life. Like even in day to day, that's a marketing.
Stop taking mine then.
That's a marketing scheme. Just work on your nutrition and get your nutrition and vitamins that way.
Organ meats, my man.
Yeah, get that bone broth and organ meats. I would. You know, seeds, 72-hour bug out bag is great. You know, knowing what you're going to do, already having a plan in place, knowing what direction you need to go, knowing the topography of the area, having landmarks, maps, things of that nature, having ways to start fire, having ways to, you know, easily and lightly carry things that you can train with your bug out bag. You know, I do this on a regular basis. It's just we go out in the woods. A couple friends and I or something like that, or I'll take the kids and we'll go and we just take our bug out bags and go out for 2 or 3 days and live out of them and see how good it is. That's how, because you need to know, you don't want to be in that situation where, you know, it's actually hit the fan and you're like, oh, you know, I should have put this in my bag. something else that's essential, V just mentioned this as well, I was about to get to this, was communications. Shortwave, ham radios, walkie-talkies, things like that. Because, you know, think about how when you forget your phone and, you know, go somewhere, how disconnected you feel. Well, imagine, you know, it doesn't work anymore at all. There's no ingesting information. You know, how are you going to get information on what's going on around your immediate sight lines? You know, you need to have a way to have inbound information. People will be using these radios. Information will be coming in. And so it's a great way to know what's coming out, what's ahead of you. What, you know, hey, don't go this direction because it's FUBAR over there. Different things of that nature. Or, hey, there's people getting together in this area. Absolutely. Know your area, have communications, food, know how to get water. You know, filtration systems are great. Things like survival straws, things like that. Knowing how to make natural filtration systems from charcoal.
What would you say about like some iodine drops or maybe some like a drop of bleach in your water?
No bleach, but you'll be shitting like a pet coon. If you fucking put bleach in your water.
That's what I actually learned that in Boy Scouts. They said that if you have a gallon of water, you can put in one drop of bleach and it will clean the water and it's safe to drink.
It is safe to drink, but it will make you shit yourself a lot. Iodine's not bad. It just makes the water terrible, like taste terrible. You know, you can always make sure that your water is filtered and extra secure by, you know, putting your iodine in there. I think you want to save that for when you're kind of like in a pinch. You don't have time to do slower filtration methods. If you've got kind of base camp set up for the night or something like that, you can easily make charcoal filters, you know, make filters out of natural material. And, you know, they take a little bit longer. But look at the job done. Filter them that way. Filter all the debris out. Boil it. And then you're good to go.
And how effective is boiling your water? Because I know that's another way of cleaning your water.
It's very effective against quite a bit of pathogens. Between charcoal filtration and boiling, it'll be perfectly safe to drink. Iodine, and like I said, if you really want to make sure, iodine will get the job done. But obviously, you only have so much iodine. And it works quickly. That's what I like, using the iodine on the pinch. Because it's
I was gonna say, like, the, you
it's
know,
quick
on the move, evacuating or something. We need to refill your water bottle. The iodine might be the quick. It was from my experience with different water filtration camping.
Yeah. But obviously the goal is to have more of a permanence set up. You don't want to be constantly on the run. And so if you haven't already, this is why we encourage people to work in this direction all the time right now before it hits the fan, to already have all these things set up, because trying to, you know, set up any type of infrastructure around yourself from just, say, the raw woods versus right now when you have access to, you know, cast iron tools that'll last you your lifetime, things like that. Like, you know, don't get spoiled on, you know, even in modernity, don't get spoiled on things that are, you know, quick use that you're going to burn out real quickly.
Well, I actually had a relevant question for you about that. It's a little bit off topic to where we were exactly, but since you brought up the cast iron tools thing, do you feel that it's wrong to, even in the short term, like say when you're setting up Folkestead stuff or Homestead stuff, to say get used to using power tools and stuff as compared to durable hand tools, as you've alluded to?
I think that people should absolutely get used to using hand tools as much as possible. There are certain times when it's just really nice to have access to, you know, a tractor for tilling, but there's plenty of ways to get around not needing one. You know, some of the most successful, like market gardeners and things like that, people that produce insane amounts of vegetation every day, you know, they do it with no real equipment. You know, some of them will get a push behind rototiller type thing, but, you know, you could run that on, you could run that on biofuels. You could run it on smoke from a fire. You know, you could run it on to tons of things that wouldn't necessarily need fossil fuel. So, and those things, you rarely ever use them. But for the most part, it's all hand tools, and you should get comfortable with that, especially if you're just trying to provide enough for your family and to sell some at farmers market, things like that. And there's no reason to have these giant industrial tools and things like that. As far as like when you're woodworking and things like that, I'm kind of spoiled on the automatic tools.
Yeah, same.
I do have like aspirations of using more, using more of the hand tools, hand planers and things like that. And I have in the past, and I just don't actually have them, right now, but,
You can use them.
I know how to use them. And so I could if needed to.
Yeah. What are the hand? There's an auger. It's got the hand auger. It's like the little twisty drill thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You do two or three holes of that, and then you're like, all right, give me the screw gun. Like,
no, absolutely. And you know, that's just like, how much do you really want to get done in a day? How much time do you have? it's one of those things where if you had, you should get comfortable with those hand tools to where you know how to use them. But that doesn't mean that you got to sit here and inconvenience yourself completely.
To go further down this rabbit hole, since you referenced using a tractor for tilling, etc., how do you feel about people that advocate using traction, you know, draft animals, even at present, versus a tractor?
More power to them. Honestly, those techniques have honestly been shown to be less effective over the long time, and you're actually, you know, destroying your land. When it comes to, you want to do as much or as little disturbing of the soil occasionally. You know, if you're needing to like build your soil up, then, you know, you can use little real simple hand tools to a broad fork, which is a real simple tool that you can just kind of move the land up a little bit, disturb it so it can get moisture and air and the microbes and things can get in there if it's compacted. But for the most part, it's like you don't want to be doing this big giant tiller action, because you're really multifold. You're tearing up the land. You're breaking its nutrition cycles. You're releasing the weed seed bank that's all stored down there underground and bringing it up to the surface. So you're actually doing more work to yourself in the long run of having to pick all these weeds and shit out of your beds in the long run. So,
Really? Because I've been, every year I till my garden and mix in more compost, to mix in more manure.
Lay that compost on top, homie.
All right. All right. That's, you know, that's just how we've always done it. So that's good information.
Yeah. I'll send you some good info on that.
Very cool.
Like permanent raised bed situations and things like that.
Do you also use cover crops instead of to fill it?
Oh yeah. Yeah. You should definitely, because you, and that's the whole thing with, like, you want to always keep the ground covered with something, whether it's a cover crop, whether you're using a freaking piece of tarp. And even when you're planting your crops, you want to have this distribution of where your crops are real close together in these rows so that it maintains a canopy over them, maintains the moisture and the shade and the warmth to keep the plants growing nice and healthy and keeps the vigor in the soil. And it's, you're getting more food per square foot, and it's a lot easier when it comes to harvest time. So it just works out better that way.
Very cool. Okay. So you've gotten out into your spot. How do you, like, how would you go about picking a location to set up your folkstead?
You want something that's, you know, relatively, well, are we talking about in full-on bug-out situation? Because full-on bug-out situation, you want to be, as you know, away from any roads, and, you know, it's a little bit different than right now. You want to be away from any kind of major roads and other people and things like that.
Would you set up traps, punji pits?
Oh, yeah. Set up them punji pits. I would totally freaking shit all over those sticks. deadfall traps, the whole works, homie. Yeah.
So like moats with like hammerhead sharks.
Oh, sure.
Maintaining the hammerhead sharks might be an unaffordable calorically, to be honest.
But, I don't know. Apparently, according to Mr. Kaiser Wayne, there's sharks in Lake Erie, so I might be in luck.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fresh waters.
Yeah, he says that there's megalodons living in there.
Oh, man. I do miss the conduit. That was a good time.
That was a good show. Great show.
No, definitely you'd want to set up traps. You'd want to set up, at the very least, you'd want to set up, you know, noise traps to where, you know, you can hear somebody coming. Start paying attention to the birds, things like that, the natural animal sounds, because they're great alarm systems to let you know when someone's coming from, you know, a mile away.
What about dogs? Would you have dogs?
No, because then you got to feed them.
Hmm.
You know, then you got to not only feed yourself, you got to feed them. You know, if I had a dog, I would take my dog with me, but I'm not going to like go out of my way to have a bunch of dogs, because they, you know, they make too much noise drawing attention to you. You know, you don't want to draw attention to yourself. Then you got to feed them, so there's calories going to waste, things like that. But I don't know. I guess there's an argument to be made for either way. I can see the benefits, but I can also see a ton of downsides. Honestly, I hadn't even thought about having dogs. It's just, I would take my current dog with me, but like I said, I wouldn't go out of my way to have dogs.
So, say you're with the dog situation, say you've begun to establish your folkstead, and getting something to eat isn't really as big of an issue anymore. You guys are not producing enough food. If you did choose to have something like guard dogs, what breed of dog would you choose?
Oh, man, that's tough. I think Dobermans are a good choice.
I mean, they're a big dog. They eat a lot.
No, you can get smaller dobies. You get good, like, European dobies. They're not that big, and they don't eat that much, but they are very loyal, very smart, let you know what's going on, and they don't take that much to train. You know, I mean, they kind of just, they have those instincts very much ingrained in them. I like hounds, but they make a ton of freaking noise. I'm kind of partial to hound dogs, honestly. I don't know. There's a lot of good choices. Obviously, German Shepherds, Labs. But
I'm a Lab guy. I like Labs, and I like Rottweilers.
Yeah, I like Labs and German Shepherds, personally.
Yeah. Shepherds are definitely... Shepherds, I definitely have a soft spot for Shepherds, for sure. They're great dogs, but they can get huge and eat a lot of freaking food.
But no cats, right? You wouldn't have cats.
Honestly, yeah, I would have cats. Ugh. I would have cats only because they are great at keeping the pests down, and they're also a great source of protein if you need it.
Well, not only that, but they tend, you know, they're at least going to get some of their own calories out of hunting mice or whatever.
That's what I'm saying. You don't have to feed them. Like, you can literally just let them roam.
Yeah, I mean, if you raise a cat to
you let them roam around. You let them roam around. They can breed willy-nilly. Let them roam.
I thought you were saying that you could just, like, have them on, you know, auxiliary just in case you got to eat one.
No, I would. Yeah, then I could easily just pop off and eat one because they're going to be roaming around everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, just eat one. That's what I'm saying. Like, they're a backup protein source. Absolutely. You know, people look at me weird now because we raise rabbits for meat and stuff. I think it's hilarious. It's like, they're freaking delicious and they're so easy. Why not? And they don't make any damn noise. So it's the ultimate stealth meat, you know?
So other than rabbits, like, say you're breeding something, would you breed? I've heard people say guinea pigs are a good breeder animal to eat.
Well, so yes and no. So on paper, guinea pigs are one of the best because they're one of the only animals ahead of rabbits that has a better meat to live weight to meat weight ratio, as well as their caloric intake returning. So like you can feed them off the grass and they need way less grass to produce the same amount of meat. So you can say, if you compare it to X number of guinea pigs is the same meat weight as one cow, well, those guinea pigs are going to use 1/100 of the grain and water for that same amount of meat, right? So on paper, they're awesome. But they're really small. They don't produce that much meat. So is it worth the effort to harvest them? That's where I think like rabbits are at that like good threshold of they're smaller, but they're at just the right amount of meat production to where it's actually worth it to keep them and to care for them and to harvest them, you know?
Yeah. I always thought a guinea pig would be like a Cornish hen. It's like a little treat.
Yeah. And like a Cornish hen, it's going to be real bony. And, you know, they don't nearly have it, all their meat would be like in their back hands and stuff like that. So it'd be like little drumsticks. You know, is it really worth caring for these little animals to get a bunch of little drumstick, little chicken wings, you know, like
guinea pig hot wings? I like it.
Sig says, quail are a great animal. Absolutely. Don't make that much noise. The noise that the roosters make, it blends in. It's really small, so it blends in very well with kind of local birds and stuff like that. So nobody's really going to pay that much attention to it. So it's a good choice. Quail's great. You know, obviously, if you wanted to have chickens for egg laying, things like that, you know, you wouldn't want a rooster if you're not trying to bring attention to yourself. I think cool. Pigs are good. Goats are good. Goats can make a lot of noise, though. Pigs are great. They're quiet. They produce a ridiculous amount of meat. And then also they're fat, lard pigs. You know, we talked about this on one of the episodes of Folkstead, the difference between a bacon pig and a lard pig. You know, bacon pigs are meat pigs. They'll still produce a certain amount of lard and fat content, but they're lean on the fat content compared to, say, lard pigs, where you will get meat, but you won't get those really good quality of bacon and stuff like that. Like the real, you know, you won't get a ton of meat off of them, but they produce a ridiculous amount of lard, which becomes very effective if you're living, you know, off the grid type of, you know, scenario like this. You'll want that to grease things, to cook things. It, you know, it's very effective.
And also, can you use that lard for that, for maybe oil for lanterns or soap or anything like that?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Sorry, Griff, what were you gonna say?
No, I was gonna mention soap or even like lubricants and stuff like that. Yeah, if you're trying to keep any machinery working, you're not gonna have to commercial lubricant.
Exactly. Lubricants, like it, lard is super effective.
Plus cooking with lard is fucking delicious.
Absolutely.
Big time.
everybody in the chat's talking about all the animals they want to eat. orangutans and owls and pandas and shit.
Bald eagle, roasted eagle.
I always suspected an eagle would just taste like, you know, a dove, like a big dove, you know, because they're pretty much like pigeons. Like they really are. They're just like giant pigeons. I figured they would just taste like big old doves.
Would you eat a bald eagle? Would you feel bad?
No, I would eat the hell out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those. It's have you ever seen that meme where it's like got that poster that like the vegans made or whatever, where it's like they draw the lines like, oh, I eat these every day. I'd eat these in a tough situation. I'd only eat these after like doomsday. And it's so funny because they have like rabbits and all this stuff like way over here on the far right. It's like, shit, I eat those every day. What are you talking about?
Yeah. Put up more posters. I might eat you.
Right?
these people just don't have any fucking perspective on scarcity, to be honest.
Yeah, it's all right. They can be slaves.
Huh. Yeah.
As long as they're not expendable or impossible to feed, they can be slaves.
So, back to pigs. How hard is it to domesticate a pig for like war purposes, like to ride it, put armor on it, like a war boar?
What, dude, man, I don't know what kind of pigs you're trying to breed. That's a big ass pig. You're a big boy.
Real pig. Real big pig.
Bruno does say to tell you to get a Doberman puppy, by the way.
Yeah, so. I have one dog and we're working on her. So, Mr. Bruno is going to be a minute till we get a second dog.
No, put some armor on a pig. Yeah, kind of, you know, what we used to do is we had hunting dogs and they would get all messed up tracking these hogs in the woods. And so we'd keep them in these like healing pens. And, what I used to do as a kid is one of my favorite things to do is like sit and wait for the hogs to come up, because the hogs would come up and like mess with them while they were in these pens. And then you just jump off and try to like stab him in the neck. And, you know, you're kind of riding on him, trying not to get your ass killed by his freaking tusks. Yeah. Trying to ride a pig is not not really, you know, something that you want to just take lightly.
Mr. Bruno, brother Bruno Fratello says, Mr. Rory, check PayPal.
And his message was to tell you to get a Doberman puppy.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll see after I, you know, start breeding war pigs, war boars. We'll see.
At least Dave has his priorities straight.
Yeah, I do. Number one, bug out bag. Number two, fresh water. Number three, war boars.
Yes, exactly. V makes a good point here. You want to have things in rat-proof containers for the long haul. You know, this is where I was saying, like, cats would come in handy when you're like, oh, no cats. I'm like, now you want to keep those mice and, you know, field mice and rats and shit down. But, you know, they do happen. They proliferate. So, you know, you want to keep anything that you want to store for, you know, the long run in things that they can't get through, metal, glass, things like that. So. Super important. Obviously, in bug out, you want to keep things as light as possible. But that's why I say, like, you want to keep somewhat proximity, not too close, but you want to be close enough to where you know where the hell it is still, and you can get there and, you know, half a day's walk or less to some type of civilization, even if it's just a little town of, you know, 500, 600 people type thing. Because even if you got to go in there just to run raids, you know, to get some supplies.
It's like Borderlands.
Yeah, absolutely. When it hits the fan, you know, morality goes out the window. It's all about survival.
Yeah, speaking of Borderlands, I've been playing Borderlands 2. If anybody has Xbox Live, hit me up. I'm a But so we've established like kind of like the homestead and stuff. How far, like, where do we go from there? Once you're established and you have a good supply of food, is that it? You just stay there? Or do we start taking steps towards, like, you know, space?
You definitely want to try to link up with other people that are surviving.
And by space, I mean like outer space.
Yeah. We'd have to, you know, rebuild civilization. And, Obviously,
except with no cats.
Yeah. Well, of course, but like, you know, intergalactic pagan supremacy is a must. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
To just step back a moment and to sort of re-square things between the bug out from urban and suburban situation versus if you have the means now to establish yourself in a rural place, how would you advise someone to find, even in the broad scale, like state or country, but on the finer scale, like where do you want to be if you're going to set up your Foldstead today or tomorrow or next year?
I would say for me personally, I want to be somewhere where you do have four seasons, but your winters aren't too harsh, right? Some people are like, you know, screw it, I'm going to Alaska, and I'm just like, no, I'm good, right? Like, I'm not afraid of cold and things like that, but if you're talking about food production for your family, that's not something that you want to put lightly and say, okay, well, here my growing season is, you know, 2.5 months of the year,
yeah,
to produce the food I'm going to need for the rest of the year.
Exactly.
You know, you have one bad crop and you're starving to death, you know? You can't put all your eggs in a basket like that. So I think that somewhere around that temperate zone, I don't have my grow zone map up here. I want to say it's like zone 8, 7, 7, 8-ish. You guys look up the national grow zones, I think it's called, for the U.S. Obviously, they have these around the world, but I'm just having to pull it up because it's driving me nuts.
That's a great point. And anybody watches my videos on my channel, and over and over again, I mentioned something that I also mention in the bloats when we do with my kindred, is we often forget how hard it was just to survive, as you know, our ancestors did. You know, every single one of our holidays is very much about survival and making it through the winter. And it's kind
of, I have to say, that one group that we as pagans tend to continually shit on, but that are absolutely incredible from this perspective, are the freaking Puritans. When they settled in Massachusetts, it was in the middle of a freaking mini ice age.
Yep.
So it was, what, 5 degrees Fahrenheit colder than it is now?
Yeah.
And they were building in the middle of just nothing. Really impressive survival and development, leaving aside our issues with their religion and politics.
Well, we've 100%. Come from people, you know, we come from a people and a stock of people who, that's what makes us good at what we do. And is because we come from people that did survive, you know, the most harsh winters in scenarios where, yeah, if you did have a bad harvest, you know,
you're done.
You may not last till the next winter. And that's the strong survived, right? But now you have a choice of making that choice of like, okay, well, let me pick a spot. And that's why I say like winters are important, because it kind of resets the ecology. It's good for many things, but you don't want your winters to just be brutal every single year.
Now, you're up here sort of in my region of kind of in the greater Northeast, and you grew up in you know, Texas, right?
Yeah.
Now, where would you rather go, knowing how, I've never been to Texas, but I know that they don't really have much, you know, much winter. And up here in, you know, in Pennsylvania, yeah, we have winter. Like, it's sometimes,
yeah,
it gets pretty nasty. Yeah, there's times that we get 3-4 feet of snow. Where would you rather be, like somewhere in a region like this or down home in Texas?
Oh, man, I don't know. That's like the two extremes. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's just Texas, it's so brutal because there's large portions of the summer where it's so hot, you know, midday you can't even do any work. Because
you're in a real collapse situation, you're going to have real water problems then.
Texas. Yeah, you're going to have water problems. I'm from more of the east side of Texas, so we didn't really have any water problems. It's not desert.
I know it's not desert. Like, you're still more likely to droughts probably than, you know, further north.
Well, I always
no air conditioning.
I always lived in around large bodies of water, so there's plenty of water. But the without AC, things like that, like not being able to really get away from that heat, you know. But
I gotta say, personally, I could never live that far south without AC. Fucking hell.
Yeah. Oh, it's absolutely, it's brutal. I lived there most of my life and I never liked it. But the thing is, like, you know, Pennsylvania is not so bad. You know what I mean? Like the winters can get harsh, but it's not like really bad.
It's obviously not Canada.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's not Canada, it's not Alaska,
Minnesota,
but it's like I think honestly, if you would just go slightly south of Pennsylvania, you'd kind of be in that perfect zone. Like I was saying, it's like grown 7A, I think it is.
So you're saying like Virginia, Nebraska, like
Virginia, Tennessee. Like I would say, like Tennessee and Virginia in that like band right there is like really nice. Because you know, even if you got down to say like southern West Virginia in Virginia, like down just a little bit more south to where you do get winter, you will get some snowfall, but it's a shorter period, so your grow seasons start earlier. You can know that you're going to have quite a few grow cycles in that year to make sure that you're going to get good harvests and you're going to have those food stores for the winter. And because, you know, as much as snow is a problem and cold for growing food, heat can be just as bad a problem. And so, you know, on our show a lot, you know, Sig, my co-host, he's from a very, you know, deserty arid region. And so he has the complete opposite problem of, you know, having to deal with the, you know, lack of water in a lot of times and keeping water retention in the ground and the excessive heat, things like that. So, it's, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a trade. Where do you want to be at? I think that in that 7A, 7B growing zone region is kind of optimal. You get your four seasons. The bugs don't get too bad because you get that cold that you know, kills off a lot of them during the winter time, holds them back. Pest problems can be minimized and you get good long growing seasons. And the ground is really fertile for most of that band, at least all along the East Coast. Until you get over to like Colorado area, which can get really deserty and sandy, loamy soil.
Yeah.
As long as you're kind of in the eastern states from like Arkansas over, you know, it's a good region.
How do you think the soil is up here in Pennsylvania area?
It's pretty good if you're in the valleys, things like that. There's a lot of rockiness though. That's the only, I would say that's one of the only downfalls for a lot of the areas. There are some good spots that are really fertile, things like that. And you can work that land and you know, work out a lot of those, out of the rocks and the pebbles, but it's really rocky. and you know, I'm up on a hill. So pretty much 6 inches down, wherever you go, it's just rock. It's just solid stone.
Yeah.
And that's a lot because it's so hilly up here that, you know, everything's on a hill or it's in a creek, you know.
Yeah, that's it. If people ever come to Pennsylvania, wherever you go, you're traveling through a valley. If you travel down any stretch of road, you look, you're going to see mountains.
Yeah.
They're not like Colorado mountains where they have like the snow on top or whatever. There's like gigantic hills.
Yeah.
They're very vegetated. I mean, it's a beautiful area. I mean, I love Pennsylvania. I'm from here. But that's really how the landscape is. It's also really, really cool because the valley, as far as cultural stuff goes, if you come to Pennsylvania, you go two counties over, people are going to have a different accent because of how insulated. I'm sure, Rory, you've noticed this. We get so insulated from being in valleys. People lived in valleys for so long. But because of the valleys, as far as you know, fertile ground, as Rory mentioned, in between the valleys, in between the mountains, we have great soil because the rain falls and it drifts down the mountains and then settles into the valleys, which sometimes results in flooding. However, the soil down in the valleys is really, really great. That's why we grow so much good stuff here in PA.
Yeah. Well, that's why, you know, I like being up on this hill because I got sight lines at like two clicks. So it's really nice. That's why bugging in is good for where I'm at.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We are coming up. We got about 10 minutes left. Mr. Rory, I wanted to ask you one more question before we... Oh, Griff, do you have any more questions for Mr. Rory?
The only one that was, and this should be a pretty quick one, was just to finish up on that question of, you know, land and site. If I was looking at establishing a real folkstead in the short term, I guess acreage, you know, if you're looking to provide for a family of, say, five or six, is there a real minimum amount of acreage that you think is sustainable?
If you're good at what you're doing and, you know, you can easily do it on an acre. There's plenty of people that do it on less. There's people that provide for families five, six, seven, eight on, you know, half an acre, quarter acre. It's all about how tight do you want things to be? How good are you at maintaining the soil? And keeping it good like that. I would say that you want a little room so that you can like paddock things around. If you want to have animals and livestock, you know, I would say if you have at least 5 acres, you're absolutely set. Like you shouldn't have any issues. As long as you rotate crops, rotate your animals around, you've got enough space to spread things around and still have some timbers to have wildlife in and do some foraging and things like that. So, you know, that's kind of like
that. You think that spot amount of land is enough even to get yourself a woodlot in the?
Yeah, if you had 5 acres, you could easily have 2 acres of just woodlands and then just use the 3 acres for farming. Absolutely. Because like I said, you could grow as far as like just vegetation space. If you're just providing for your family, you could easily do that on half an acre. Easily, very easily. Half an acre is giving you tons of space to move around. And then you got the rest of it for your livestock to have places to roam around. So, absolutely.
I think people underestimate how big an acre is. An acre is pretty darn big.
What is it, 42,000 square feet?
Yeah. If your yard is an acre, that's going to take you like over an hour to mow. Yeah, it's gonna. If you're on a riding mower, if you're push mowing, and actually, I wouldn't push mow an acre. I'll just let some of it overgrow.
I'm on a half an acre right now, and it's like the hardest part is it's the hill. Like I said, I have a lot of incline, decline. Actually, just all decline, which means you got to go up it. But you know, that's what makes it hard. It's manageable with a push mower. Yeah, if you're trying to push mow a couple acres, you're going to be out there a while.
It's going to take you a whole day. It's going to take a while. But, Mr. Roy, I have one more question before we shut it down. And,
sure.
This kind of takes, I mentioned Ragnarok before. And, you know, those of us that are familiar with the Eddas and familiar with the story of Ragnarok and how the world freezes over and it's the story of how, you know, the gods die and, you know, there's... We could go into what the Ragnarok is. I mean, I implore you guys to go read it. But kind of the overarching story of Ragnarok is that, you know, essentially it's an ice age and the world ceases to be and then it starts the cycle again. And Mr. Roy, we've had so many conversations about cyclical time and rising and falling civilizations and
absolutely.
Even some of the esoteric, you know, conspiracy stuff behind it. However, I guess this is kind of like a two-part question. How feasible do you think the theory of like grand solar minimum is? And what do you think the percentage chance is that we are coming up on something like that, a great cataclysm or environmental shift, and we would have to employ this stuff that we are talking about tonight?
I think that there is a lot of evidence to the grand solar minimum. And I think that if the cycles that seem to be kind of the foreshadowing of these massive events, whether it is a grand solar minimum or some other type of cyclical event that's, you know, what is the cause? What is the source? You know, there's lots of debate there, but there definitely is a cyclical process that seems to bring about catastrophe and chaos and wipe civilization out. And we're definitely seem to be overdue on that clock. So I say that it could happen in your time or it could happen in your children's time or your grandparents' time. Or the grandchildren's time. But the thing is that if you don't maintain these skills, re-harness these skills that your grandparents and every generation before them had, then your kids and you, your kids and their kids are all going to be doomed, right? So it's up to you to be that generation to break the cycle of these forgotten skills and re-hone what it means to be a human being, re-hone what it means to be a European, and pass that down to your future generations because their survival and yours depends on it.
Very, very cool. Very powerful closing, Mr. Rory. But you know, we got a few minutes left, so I'm going to close out with some plugs. Mr. Griff, do you have anything to say in conclusion?
No, I think this was a good show. Glad we brought Rory on. It's great to talk to him.
Rory's a pro. He always does a good show. Mr. Rory, would you like to do some plugs?
Yeah, you know, as you said in the beginning of the show, obviously on here on the network, myself and my co-host Sig, we do the Folkstead on Saturdays at 6 p.m. I know we missed last week. We had some scheduling things come up, but we will be back this Saturday at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can check me out, our other content. I'm going to be putting out some new different types of content over on my original home channel of Verbo Tempestas. And definitely go and check out the other shows we have here on the network. And check out my friends over at the Revolutionary Conservative and over at the Vanguard Streaming Network. Good guys over there. Lots of good content. And that's all for me.
Very, very cool. All right, we're going to close it out for this evening, but I'd like to thank Mr. Rory again for coming on. You're a really good friend of mine. Known him for a long time now. Really, yeah, I remember this guy, you know, when he first started Verbo Tempestas, and I was like, these guys are gonna blow up, and they blew up way bigger than old Dave did. I'm really proud of them, and they've been producing so much good content for so long, Mr. Rory and his co-host Kaiser. So I'd like to thank him again for coming on, and I implore you guys to check out all Rory's content. Rory does so much good content. You know, as I said in the beginning of the show, you know, guys just the man, you know, war hero, father of five, husband, has a beautiful family, beautiful wife. He's just the fucking man. So make sure you go check out all of his content, Verbo Tempestas, and check out his Folkstead, where he said Saturdays at 6 p.m. So make sure you check that out. I'd like to thank Mr. Griff for coming on and being my co-host. Mr. Griff is going to be back with me next week on The Bog right here on Rolf and Volk Network. That you should like, share, subscribe, share with your friends if you like our content. You know, we're going to keep coming, man. We got so much good stuff coming your way for you, all you guys, whether it's, you know, over on Folkstead, like we talked about, you know, with all their permaculture talk and talking about animal husbandry and, you know, cultivating the land and all that good, wholesome, down-home kind of stuff, or it's on Hen House with the Mother Hen. I love Mother Hen, man. She is really, really great. Great show. Talks about, you know, traditional values, motherhood, family stuff. You know, all that. Man, she's wonderful. So make sure you check her out. And also check out the mighty Stephen McNallen on God's Folk and Destiny every single Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern, or The Bog right here Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern. Man, we got so much good shows. This is like my favorite network on the internet. I'm not saying that because I'm a part of it. I'm saying it because it objectively is. I'm sorry. Yo, competitors out there, I love you guys. You guys are my boys. Get on Rolf and Volk level. You know, that's all I'm going to say. Yeah, I'm just kidding. But anyway, thank you guys so much for tuning in. Like, subscribe, share. A few quick plugs before we finish. My homegirl, Miss Hannah, traditional apothecary. I'm telling you guys, stop buying that stuff from Unilever, Procter & Gamble, all these goofballs. They're selling you poison. They're selling you poison. They take your money. They hate your guts. Look at their advertising. Look at their commercials. They demonize you. They do not like you, and they're selling you things that are trashing your body. Support folk economy. We need to get money exchanging between folkish hands. There's, you know, for us, by us. We need our own infrastructure. And, you know, there's a meme going around that was like, you know, after that commercial that Gillette came out with that was anti-white male and all that crazy hateful stuff that they're coming out with, they hate us. You know, everyone's like, oh, how are we going to opt out? We can't opt out. They own everything. They have this myriad of tentacles that slithers in and out of every single nook and cranny of the economy. They have the market cornered. Let me tell you guys, that's completely false, and I have it right here in my hand. They, you know, she has wonderful stuff, man. Lotion, beard oil, shampoo, conditioners, anything you can think about that's, you know, healthcare, beauty care products. I'm telling you, you're going to love it. Your wife's going to love it. Your mom's going to love it. Everybody's going to love it. Traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. And I got a deal with her. Wonderful, wonderful lady. Wonderful lady. I did an episode with her on The Bog here, I guess like a month or two ago. Traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Promo code Dave for 10% off. I swear you're going to love it. And then a couple more plugs real quick. Make sure to pick up a copy of the Odinist Edda. The Odinist Edda from my boys, my colleagues over at the Nerna Society. It took Mr. Mark Pereer 20 years to compile this. 20 years. That's how long this guy's been in the business. Longer than that. The guy's been in the business longer than I've been alive. So get a copy of this. I swear. This has to be on every single folkish bookshelf. And make sure you follow it up with a copy of this. The Otis book, where he goes through, he does deeper philosophy about the Eddas and about Ossetru and all kinds of good stuff. Or if you're already familiar with the Ossetru lore, you can pick up this, the Yasa Trueta, which has it's a little bit more authentic and it has a lot of the ancient language and stuff like that. So make sure you guys pick that up. And one more book. I'm going to throw a plug out for my buddy Terry Unger. He writes like crime thrillers. This one's called Blood Money. As a character, Nick Hammer. It's like old school style, you know, crime thriller. It's about this guy, Nick Hammer, who goes, it solves all these mysteries, and he's a real rough around the edges kind of guy. Mr. Terry is a, you know, an elder in the community. He's an author. He's got quite a few books. He's an Oscar True guy. Really, really great guy. Nice guy down there, down south. And he writes these books. So if you like suspense and you like crime thrillers, pick up a copy of this. Or if you know anybody that does, you know, get it for a gift for them. But that's enough plugs for tonight. But thank you guys so much for tuning into The Bog. We'll be back here, me and my co-host, Mr. Angriff, as we tear into all kinds of awesome stuff. I don't know what we're going to do next week, but I know it's going to be great. So tune into The Bog next week, Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern. I am Big Dave Martell. This is Angriff and Rory from Verbo Tempestas. Hail the gods. Hail the folk. Hail Hrafnvolk. Take care. Good night.